CliffCentral.com.
Take it away, Tina. We don't need another hero. She doesn't perform anymore. She lives in Switzerland. She's married, retired, and so happy. Like, she has no desire to return to the stage. But I'm sure there are plenty of people who would pay her a lot of money to come back on the stage. Sure. I should have played another song, though, and Pumi just reminded me. She was on Instagram or something, and then I know I posted something last night, that last night was the only time you could have really played Don't you remember? Then in September. Because it was, do you remember? 21st of September. Am I right? So that was the day, yesterday, the 21st of September. The only time you could have played that song.
How are you going to tell him?
It's so nice.
It's so nice. It is. Very good. Okay, so there we go.
Okay, I've messaged him as well. Otherwise, I'll call.
What's this? What are you talking about?
He's just in his own mood.
Oh.
Guys, you don't know.
I've been muted. I was talking about how Pumi told, she showed me her screen. Sorry. That's so embarrassing.
You're having so much fun on your own.
The most muted, the most quoted line of 2020 is, am I
on mute?
You're
muted. Yeah, exactly.
So, all right, so I'm back on. Sorry. How stupid. So I was saying, when I started killing Tina Turner's song, I was like, oh, I should have played September, right?
Ah, the 21st of September.
Maurice White, guys.
That's
Maurice
right. And we were talking
White.
About them just the other day, remember? They were honored in the Kennedy Center Honors not so long ago. And you were going to say, Pumps?
Still out there holding those notes.
Damn
holding
right.
Holding those notes, putting young
Damn
people
right.
to shame.
But anyway,
young people with their Fruity Loops or whatever they use these
wow.
days.
The important thing here being that Earth, Wind & Fire, obviously, when they wrote that song, the only day when you can play that song without any irony is the 21st of September. Do you remember? 21st of September. And that was yesterday, so I'm sorry. We missed a trick there to play that song. Ah, very good.
Although, you know, you played Tina Turner. I mm-hmm. listened to a podcast with Tina Turner and Oprah. Sia, do you see me? Listening to Oprah's episode Sundays.
Uh-huh.
Oh, but, you know, because Tina Turner recently got married to her longtime young lover.
Right.
And it always fascinates me. It always fascinates me.
Young by like 15 years.
Dude. Well, he's much younger than her. Doesn't she
live very happily in Switzerland now with him? And
she does.
She's retired.
And she speaks about that. But the thing that was unbelievable to listen to was how she got ready for her retirement. And how, because do you guys know that Tina Turner was born on a plantation?
No, I didn't. I know that while she was married to Ike, she pretty much lived in one. That much I know.
Ooh, dude. And she is candid in that interview. And she's Buddhist.
Yeah.
She talks about how she felt. How she didn't actually even kind of feel anything when Ike passed away a couple of years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And how everybody in the whole world was waiting for her to make a statement. Then she was just like, I ain't got nothing to say, y'all. It's like when somebody you used to know dies and you don't know them anymore. You ain't got nothing to say. It's amazing. But getting ready for retirement, she went on that huge tour, remember, for about a year and a half. And that was her plan. That was just basically her fundraising for her retirement.
That's right.
Got rid of some of her properties. And we forget when we're at a concert, when we watch a really good performance, we forget that person on stage is at work, you know, because it's so great for us and we're having so much fun. And she just talked about how it was taking a toll on her body, all of the stilettos,
yeah,
the red bottom stilettos.
Listen, she's a real performer. I mean, she didn't She didn't like give you a half price ticket. You got the full show out of Tina, and she would dance and she would sing her heart out. And I mean, it was just exhausting for her.
Around on that stage. Yeah. Now he's gone. But it was really amazing. You got to hear that podcast with Tina Turner. If you do think she's simply the best, it'll make her even
because
more.
Another thing with Tina is she and her music aren't like a Mariah Carey, for example. I think Mariah Carey can still sing if she wants to in her 80s. She'll just lean against a piano and she can sing about I Want to Know What Love Is. You don't want to hear simply the best.
No.
And Tina's just saying that you need the moves. You need exactly.
No. Also, I mean, like Mariah is just the laziest performer in the universe.
We know this.
Tina put Tina's old school in that respect. I mean, she grew up in the era where you had to do it all. You had to sing and dance and perform and act. Right. And Mariah's just lazy with a great voice. No, she is. She really is. If you went to a Tina Turner show, you went to a show. You go to see a Mariah Carey show, what you're really doing is pitching up to hear someone sing. That's all.
Yeah.
Pitching up for the live version of the CDs you have at home.
Exactly. And sometimes she can't even reach those notes anymore. So I don't know that Mariah can belt it out like she used to. She really just waits. All she does is wait for Christmas. When that I Don't Want a Lot for Christmas song comes. She even does a countdown every year now. She's taking the piss. She's like, I'm in it for the royalties. Bring it on.
But she is a bit of an auntie now, hey. Mm. Auntie Mariah in a lot of ways. She looks
so listen to this quickly. Pumi, this is really interesting. Apparently, COVID-19 lawbreakers in Indonesia are being punished in an interesting way. They are being forced. So if you break the law in Indonesia, and let's say you break curfew or you don't follow lockdown regulations or you pass on COVID unknowingly and then they catch you, they make you dig graves as punishment.
Right.
How stupid is this?
Don't tell Big Ukraine that.
he'll think that's a great idea. Well, I want to dig graves.
It is the least of the craziness coming from Indonesia. So specifically in the region of East Java, the law enforcement there has agreed that that is a great idea. If you break the law and around COVID-19 regulations, having to dig graves is just one of the things that you have to do. What you might also have to do is you might have to lie down in a coffin.
I don't know
what it is, their fascination with death here.
Well, I think Indonesia still has a few of those cults where you actually, every year you dig up your dead and you make them sit at the dinner table with you. No, they've got some, they've got some very weird death cult thing going on. And that part of the world is also, ironically, just part of Indonesia is Borneo. And Borneo is one of the few places in the world where they know for a fact that there are still cannibals living.
Mm-hmm.
So weird. You might
and they
also
get that disease.
Which disease?
It's like some kind, not like rickets, it's like a shaking disease. Ooh. There's a whole village. I saw a thing on National Geographic once. The whole village. First of all, I was just like, y'all know these people are cannibals and no one's stopping this. Oh, okay, then go on with your bad stuff.
Who's going to stop cannibals? Do you want to go and say and reason with the cannibals?
There they were taking a documentary, filming a documentary. Filming a documentary is not a 2-minute experience. It's a good couple of years that they're spending with the people. But as they get older, they have this rare disease that they believe is linked to eating human flesh, but they get all like shaky like this.
Oh,
like,
wow. That's horrible.
It was the weirdest thing I have ever seen. There's so many things about a documentary about cannibals, right?
I hope we're not doing what often happens where people know a little bit about a country like Indonesia, and then we only say the shitty things, and maybe some of them aren't even true. But I certainly know that Borneo, the island, which is part of Indonesia, that place is really, like, it's pretty scary. There are cannibals. There are people that have actual pots that they've cooked people in. And
that's a proper shit show.
Yeah, see,
pardon my friend.
You would not like Indonesia.
Only because you don't even eat meat, yeah, so I don't know what you're talking about.
No.
But that wouldn't that make him more tasty and more healthy for us? Like, if we had to eat someone, wouldn't we want to eat Sia rather?
And look, I know Bali is very, like, Instagram worthy, but I didn't enjoy it at all. It was too much. And, like, I need my creature comforts, and I didn't find them there.
You found creatures, not comforts.
Exactly. Hmm. So in this region of East Java, yeah, digging graves is just one of the punishments that you might have if you break some of their lockdown regulations. What you also might have to do, as I mentioned earlier, lying down in coffins. You might have to pray for COVID-19 victims.
Mm.
And then, well, I think they just threw this in for good measure. You might be punished by doing push-ups as well.
Yeah, it sounds stupid. It sounds like this government is just out of control. Yeah, a lot of stupidity has come about because of this thing. But can we talk quickly? I know, Sia, you're burning to tell us more about Epstein, and there are apparently requests that are coming from the American Virgin Islands, the government there, obviously. They want to know what was in the Epstein logs. In other words, who was on those planes, how many times they were there. Yes, and how many times they came to and from Epstein Island. Have we got any new stories that are starting to develop here?
So I think over the past couple of months with this whole Epstein drama, there have been rumors about who might have been and who was possibly seen, but we didn't really get confirmation up until what it seems we will be getting over the next few weeks. The top prosecutor is now getting involved and saying that they demand 20 years of flight logs from all of Jeffrey Epstein's fleet. So that includes 4 helicopters and 3 planes. And this will go back as far as 1998.
Hmm.
So now we will get confirmation as to not who might have been a friend, in inverted commas, of Jeffrey Epstein. But I would say if you go as far as flying halfway across the world with someone, and if you're flying to his private island, there's no way you can say, oh, no, I didn't know. No, I don't know anything. So shit is going to get real. All we know, and yes, I've also seen like some of the sort of memes of names that are speculated, but the only ones that have been officially confirmed were by a pilot, David Rogers, who provided blogs back then to reveal that Prince Andrew, Bill Clinton, Kevin Spacey, and Naomi Campbell have been on board one of Epstein's jets. But now we're going to get some more.
Well, I'm not surprised, but it's going to be so embarrassing. Like, what if Bill Clinton was there every second weekend? You know, well, like, what if Bill went there so regularly, like they had his usual seat on the plane?
I just want to say I did not go to Epstein Island more than 48 times. I was there 47 times, but not 48.
There's this hilarious, hilarious picture. I think Donald Trump Jr. tweeted it out of like Hillary Clinton going off on, because they're obviously at home, right? They're in lockdown. So she's going off on this microphone in front of her laptop, and in the background, Bill is sitting, and he looks so bored and he looks so frustrated. And then they show a picture of Bill when Ariana Grande was singing at the funeral of, who was it?
Aretha Franklin.
Aretha Franklin, that's right. And Ariana Grande is dancing in front of Bill Clinton, and it's at a funeral. And the facial expression of Bill Clinton behind Ariana Grande is like the most excited, happy, engaged, enthusiastic Bill. And then they show like the picture with Hillary, and the caption is something like, poor Bill, he was more excited at a funeral than when he's having to listen to Hillary's ranting. How do you like that?
Oh,
poor Bill.
That's rough, man. That's rough.
Please. It must be really rough married to Hillary Clinton. That's what's rough, I'll tell you what.
No, yeah.
I don't think she ever stops. And I mean, she's got ammo, right? So she can always say, Bill, you're lucky I even tolerate you because of what you've done and how you've publicly humiliated me and your daughter. You're lucky I even treat you with even a modicum of respect. Because she can always throw that at him, right?
Yeah, I would. And look, I admit I am petty, but I would as well.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
why?
You've made a mockery of me since for years now.
No, but if you make the decision to stay, if you make the decision to tolerate it, if you, mm-hmm. then that's it. You can't hold it over a person's head. You're complicit, right? You have made the decision to stay.
Yeah.
Get over it.
We don't know what happened.
I hear you, Pumi, but I think that, like, she still holds all the cards. Come on.
Mm.
You know. Bill.
I don't know.
We don't know.
That.
Maybe Bill's power was important to him to the point where he begged and said, okay, look, if you stay with me, sure, we'll sleep in separate wings of the house, and you know, I'll help you possibly run for president as well.
The two of them, there's obviously a symbiosis there. They need each other to some degree, but I don't think that there's a whole lot of love. I don't think that, you know, they're sleeping in the same bed, kissing each other goodnight. I don't think that's happened for years.
No.
You disagree?
Why not? Why? Because, I mean, even before he ran for president, mm-hmm. this is well-known information, even before he ran for president, there were some skeletons coming out of the governor's mansion, many that had to be cleaned up in
That's
order
right.
for him to be able to run.
Yep.
So that isn't a new life that they live. It's just the life that they have. It may be for us sitting out here, it's a life that we look into and go, ew, it's discomfort. You know?
That's
but
just
it's
what
the
they
life
do.
That they've lived for years. For years.
Anyway, I just think it would be really bad if they do turn out these flight logs, and it's like Bill has been there every couple of days.
Oh, look, I can't wait to get out of here and go to Epstein Island.
So excited.
The Attorney General, her name is Denise George, is just appealing to anyone who worked for Jeffrey Epstein and the likes, who knows anything, to speak up. She says she is seeking complaints or reports of potentially suspicious conduct and any personal notes written by the pilots and names and contact information for all those who interacted with or observed Epstein or any passengers connected to him. One of the people who has already put their hands up and said, yeah, I'll speak, is a private chef of Jeffrey Epstein, who has already confirmed that she, while they worked on a couple of flights where Prince Andrew was on board.
He's another slimy bastard. So let's just talk for a minute, because there seem to be a lot of slimy people in the world right now. So listen to this story, because it's kind of slipped under the radar with COVID and everything else happening this year. You know, we've had more important things to worry about. And Epstein is obviously the big sex scandal of the last however many years. But this has been going on in Florida. The former 2018 Democratic nominee for governor in Florida is a guy called Andrew Gillum. Now, this dude, have you heard? You laughing because you know the story, right? Sia, I know you have the stories here. So he was found drunk in a room with a male escort who supposedly overdosed on methamphetamine. So he was dead, right? Now
he actually survived.
He survived?
No,
okay, so
the escort survived.
All right, so there was a male escort in a hotel room. This guy was there. He was found drunk in the room by the police. This overdose happened. Now he's out for rehab. And he's actually going around trying to revive his political career. If you could survive this, you could survive anything.
So far, doesn't it seem like it is something out of a Washington, D.C. TV series?
Yeah, it feels almost like the script to a knockoff version of House of Cards. For example.
It's kind of the worst thing you want to happen if you are wanting to be the shiny politician who can do no wrong. Yeah. But yeah, this, I feel annoyed that I somewhat ignored this and didn't catch wind of this. But his name is Andrew Gillum. Mm-hmm. And at a point a couple of years ago, he was being billed as the next Barack Obama. He served as the mayor of Tallahassee from 2014 to 2018, and he was really rising up the ranks. Slowly but surely. And he was running for governor in Florida in 2018. And he only like lost by 30,000 votes. And so they say, okay, in the greater scheme of things, that's not a lot of votes. Like, he almost made it. But he had this grand rah-rah speech at the end of it saying, you know, I am here for you, my people. I will run again. I will not leave you. Mm-hmm. Well, cut to a couple of weeks after losing. And he was... on his way, so also picture perfect family. His wife and kids were going to join him later on in the day, but he arrived first. And this is now the story according to Andrew. He was bored in Miami and he just wanted to go out for a drink. Hmm. And he remembered a guy he only met once before who lives in Miami, right? This is what he says. And he said, well, he messaged this guy and says, look, hey, I'm around. Do you want to go for a drink? They meet for a drink at a hotel bar. Somehow, they then decide to also book a room at the hotel and they go upstairs. What complicates the situation as well is the fact that later on, a man Andrew says he doesn't know joined the party as well. But that was a man who turned out to be an escort. They had a couple more drinks, and all Andrew remembers is being woken up a couple of hours later by the police and paramedics saying, do you know this man who has now overdosed on crystal meth? And he says no. And by the way, Andrew was found in a pool of his own vomit naked.
Yeah, it sounds just way too complicated. And this guy is looking for a way out of something which seems a lot more obvious to me. You know, there's something called Occam's razor, which you use to figure out whether or not something is as complex as it needs to be or whether there's a simple explanation. So you're found in a pool of your own vomit, naked. There's a male escort in the room who's overdosed on methamphetamine. There isn't this other person who you said was there who you've met once or twice in Miami before. The simplest explanation is exactly what you see. He hired a male escort. It got a bit freaky. There were some drugs involved. There was certainly a lot of booze involved. So it was a disaster. Why make it more complicated than that? Oh, hang on. Because you're trying to revive your political career.
So all kind I'm going to say, guys, for you, is that America is a shit show. Politics in America is insane. Insane at the best of times, right? Mm. And what America has done so incredibly well, thank you, Hollywood, is projected into the world this idea, this ideal like America that is, you know, home of the brave, land of the free.
Yes.
Clean.
But I don't see
happy,
this. But put me
shiny.
I don't see this as an America thing. I think this is one dude who's made some really interesting life choices, and the chickens come home to roost. I mean, this could happen in any other country. We've seen scandals like this in Britain, and we've seen them in France. And
my point is, these kinds of stories escape every so often out of America, and every time we're like, these politicians. I mean, when we first heard the word sexting, was an American politician sending like voice.
Was it Wiener? Yeah.
And his surname was Wiener, Anthony Wiener. I mean, it's. But I mean, we are no better. We're no better. Look, it's Malusi Gigaba with his dick pics that were floating around for everyone
don't
to
have
see.
To go far.
Except for the fact that there is no misconception that there is like this shiny veneer of
No. But
good
I,
politics.
I don't.
Great country, make America great again.
No, I don't. Kind of, I think you're putting America on a pedestal in your head. It's not. I don't think this is true for America only. And you know what? In this country, when it happened to our guy, he was Minister of Finance. That's like right in the top echelon of government. This dude is like a failed candidate for Florida governor, and it's still a news story. I think these kinds of things happen all over the world.
Were we just having a conversation about a former president of America making multiple trips to, like,
correct,
with a... absolutely. A known pedophile
and,
to accept
and
island.
What about...
Like, come on, guys.
No, but if there's going to be a soft bigotry of low expectations, let it be around our former president, Jacob Gedleyihlekisa Zuma, who was essentially sleeping with daughters of some of his friends. You know, if we're going to talk about creepy, the fact is these politicians are not better people than the rest of us. In fact, more often than not, they are worse.
They are worse.
Yeah. So
they are worse if politicians, guys.
If we're going to have a discussion about the morals of politicians, we're going to be here for a very short time.
So if you want to just watch a cringe fest, you can watch Andrew Gillum and his wife being interviewed for the first time about this. You know, sort of mirroring my theory on the Clintons, I think it's more than just adhering to social distancing in that interview. It doesn't look like they really want to be close to one another, but I think they just want to make the image work for as long as possible
He seems like a very clean-cut dude. I mean, he seems like he's, you know, he's an upstanding member of society. When you look at the pictures, you kind of get this idea that this is the sort of guy who wouldn't let you down, right?
Mm.
And he's meanwhile he's leading this double life. This is what I find so entertaining. Is, you know, if you're going to be in politics, if you're going to be in politics, the stuff is going to find its way out, and it's going to matter. You know, if Pumi leads a double life, Pumi's responsible for her own life. The only people she has to explain herself to are her children and her family. She doesn't owe anyone else. She's not going around kissing babies hoping for votes. But this guy is.
But that's the thing, right? There is this expectation in America, at least in the voting public of America, that you have to be this white picket fence husband and father and every single time. Those are the Achilles heels that trip all of them up. It's like, why is the wife there being a good wife, hanging out, holding his hand, like as he goes on his apology tour? Why couldn't he just come out of rehab and say, look, guys, this is the life that I'm living, you know, I'm just, you know.
Because she's also part of it. now they said they've chosen to stay together. They will remain married. And they say, actually, Andrew is bisexual. Oh. And he told me as the wife. And this is something that we never wanted. We felt the need to disclose.
And they've got kids.
Yeah, three kids.
Wow. You see, now that's just these kids one day, because they're going to go on the internet one day and they'll search their father.
They don't have to go on the internet to search their father. There's going to be some bully kid at school.
Yeah, that's true.
That's going to just bring it up. That's just going to be like, me.
Yeah, no, that's true. But still, you got to feel sorry for the children. I hope they.
I tell you all the time, children are horrible little beasts, and those poor kids are going to be at school, and there's going to be some kid that's going to like wave it in their face,
they'll
be walking past, and people will be like sniggering behind their backs.
Oh my God!
Action is bound to happen.
Oh, let me tell you. Well, I've been wondering, as I'm sure you have, for the longest time about this 5G that everybody's talking about. So supposedly it's just going to be better than 4G. But we've got someone here on the line who's actually an expert in this. He's a 5G specialist. His name is Rian Nell, and we've tracked Rian down. And thank you, Rian, for making some time for us this morning. There's so much nonsense being spoken about 5G. I really felt like it was about time that we got the real facts from an expert. So tell us... Tell us quickly about your background and what you do so that we can get an idea of what you know for us.
Good morning, guys. I trust you're well.
Morning. Yeah, very well. Nice to see you.
Guys, just to quickly frame what we're actually busy doing is, you know, there is a lot of talk going on about 5G. And, you know, when this whole pandemic struck South Africa and the rest of the world, we kind of, because I work in PR, and we kind of started looking into this, and we started seeing that, you know, what is 5G all about? Why are people using technology to sometimes be negative about technology, which is the funniest thing in the world? And then, you know, I started actually looking into the industry of 5G and 4G, and we wrote an article called The 5Gs of Connectivity.
Okay.
Which you can find on the CapeTownGuy.co.za. You guys will also,
we'll post a link to that at the end.
Yeah. So basically, what we said is, listen, let's look at 5G, let's look at 4G, and let's look at not the end brand like the cell phone networks, but let's look where this comes from, and let's look at the compliance that these guys has to literally jump through, the massive amount of compliance that these guys has to adhere to for them to be able to do their work. And then mainly also to realize that, you know, the guys who our connection, our ability right here, as we talk, I'm talking to you guys over, you know, using technology, using 5G or 4G, literally starts in a factory where companies do grassroots empowerment, women empowerment, community upliftment, because these cell phone tree masts that are being manufactured, and we don't even see them. Or we see them, but we don't see them.
Yeah, we've become used to them. I mean, we've seen them. We've seen them already for a couple of years, you know.
Yeah, and these things literally start in a factory where companies literally do empowerment, female empowerment, women empowerment, grassroots empowerment.
All right, but can I just start with the basic stuff? Because for a lot of us, this is novel.
And then we started getting compliance, and we found so much.
Rian, I just want to start at the basics, because there are a lot of us who are still...
Yes, I'm here.
We're not as informed as you are.
Yes.
And as far as we know, 5G is just like 4G, but it's better. It's faster. It gives you greater connectivity. It allows you to transfer data at a much faster rate. Is that more or less correct as a baseline understanding of what 5G is?
I think what people need to realize is, to get too technical about what 4G or 5G is won't really help you, because we've gotten used to that little G on our cell phones.
Yes.
5G obviously is much faster. It will allow us to do more. It will allow technology to assist us more. And obviously you get your people who tend to be negative. You know, if you can literally go and research when 3G came out, 4G came out, now 5G, people tend to find negative spin-offs about it. But what you should be doing, actually, if you want to go and research about this, is go and research about compliance. Go and look at the massive amount of compliance that these manufacturers have to go through to assure that what they provide is safe.
So Rian, I mean, we live in a country where, for example, you can't apply to be a network or even decide your prices without speaking to the authorities first. And we have a very regulated telecommunications sector in South Africa, and there are lots of hoops they have to jump through. And as you say, compliance is a big part of that. So why is it that people, when 3G came out and when 4G came out, they started buying into conspiracy theories and nonsense, and now they're doing it even more with 5G? Is it just because we live in a crazy time and people are panicking about corona, and they're panicking about the government, and they're panicking about this and that and the other, and they're trying to find something to blame? Is it that, or is it the fact that there is something we need to know that we don't know?
No, there is nothing that's being hidden when it comes to, you know, being connected and using 5G. I think it's just a human tendency to kind of drive conversation about negativity.
Right.
I mean, you can look at corona, and, you know, you can look at all these things. And that's, again, kind of why we did this whole 5G's of connectivity article. We wanted to just inform people that, listen, there's much more going on than the normal negative spin-offs. There's much more happening on ground level in the industry behind being connected than you guys realize.
Mm.
And as we are now using technology to be negative about technology, we're kind of being a bit hypocritical in a sense, you know. So,
well, I mean, it has to be said also, it's a certain kind of person that finds a reason to complain about these things. And there's certain kinds of people who love buying into conspiracy theories. And those people are not always the ones you should listen to at the braai.
Most definitely not. And, you know, again, that drives me back to why we did this. We kind of just wanted to put a positive spin on technology, because if you think about it, when this pandemic hit, you know, we were able, through technology, through 4G and 5G, to connect our kids to Google Classroom.
Mm.
We were able to inform ourselves about this pandemic. We were able to actually talk to one another when we weren't allowed to see one another. And all thanks to these tree masts in our neighborhoods. If they weren't there, our connectivity wouldn't be there.
Yeah.
And that's, again, why we decided to look at the industry behind the industry. Because, you know, I know that, you know, even getting this pandemic, corona and 5G, but, you know, you have to listen to yourself and say it.
You broke up a little bit there for a second. Just repeat that.
So when you look at this, when this pandemic hit the world, you know, there was also those conspiracy theorists who kind of wanted to blame this on 5G. But I think what you have to do is, when you say things like that, you have to do it in front of a mirror and just kind of, you know, realize what.
Okay, so Rian, let's talk about this for a second. How is the rollout of 5G going in South Africa, and who are the people behind this? Because I would imagine it's the big three networks primarily, big four networks primarily. Yeah. They're the ones who want to provide this level of connectivity to people. It's going to mean faster, better internet for many of us. It's going to mean that our mobile phones will be able to do things at a better rate, and probably there'll be technology that accompanies that that'll allow us to do new things with our phones.
Yeah.
This is exciting stuff. How's the rollout going?
Well, I think the rollout's going, you know, as planned and as quickly as, you know, we, the companies are allowed to basically do it. And for us, you know, we don't want to, we're not doing this campaign to actually talk about the brands doing it. We're not, we're actually just informing people. We're doing an interest piece on this because we're doing a next one as well where we're saying, listen, how is technology and can be used to actually fight gender-based violence and stuff like that as well. So we're moving towards a whole plan. We want to inform consumers about just the industry and what's going on around it. 5G is going good, and 4G, but you know, we don't realize it. Like I said, we just drive past a school or drive past an office building or drive past a neighborhood, and we just see these tree masts, and we kind of just don't think about it. We just see the data there. And the more of them you see but don't see, the more you realize that we are being connected at a quicker rate than ever.
You mentioned earlier, and we're in a country where we have massive unemployment, and any new sector of the economy that can generate jobs, we should be very happy about. Do we have any idea of how many people are being employed in the network business to connect us to 5G, to be able to make this infrastructure available, to actually do the hard work that goes on, as you say, when we just connect our phones?
Well, you know, if you look at when we did research, you know, we found quite a few companies who actually end up, you know, manufacturing these three mast towers. And, you know, at some of them, there are large groups of women working from, you know, from communities being pulled in to help manufacture these three masts. So I would imagine that through the industry, and as the industry keeps on growing and as these things are keep being put up and built, I would imagine this would employ thousands of people, and more than that, empower thousands of people, because you know, this technology is something that never changes, and it has to be you know, kept up to date, and it has to be maintained. So if you think about this industry, technology is one of the most sustainable employment industries there actually is, because it's always evolving, always changing. And so there's always going to be people needed to manufacture from ground level up, people to go install, people to go and maintain. So this industry is actually, you know, for us, just unlocking a cell phone and coming on the Gareth Cliff show, you know, there's a lot more happening in making this possible for us to just accept as natural.
You're absolutely right. And when we have load shedding and we all lose our Wi-Fi at home, then our phones just switch over to whatever mast is nearest. And that's where we suddenly realize, hell, we really do need this stuff. Even if we have a workplace where there's Wi-Fi, even if we have a home where there's Wi-Fi, even in some cases where people have Wi-Fi on the go. But I think that this is terrific. So listen, thanks for clearing it up. For me, it's not a big conspiracy. I know that you never believed this for a second.
But, so yeah, coronavirus then, not 5G.
No.
Okay, I'm just checking. Since it wasn't explicitly said. I've seen the Facebook posts.
Yeah.
Believe that.
If you get
there. Okay. No, I just want it to be explicitly like said, so that everybody walks away from this conversation being that much better. Né?
Yeah, guys, you guys are posting the links. Go and read the article. Go and look at this industry. Understand it better. And I think more importantly than ever, remember, technology is there to help you, and so use it. It's called Google. It's called search, and go find the facts.
Exactly. And also, this will help you to figure out which of your friends you should keep on social media and which ones you can get rid of.
Exactly.
All right. So thank you, Rian. We'll be putting your article up on cliffcentral.com. And if you want to go and see what Rian wrote there with all the detail and links to various other areas of interest around 5G, so you can just inform yourself and be aware of what's going on. A lot of people are confused by this stuff. And every time there's a new technology that comes out, people think, it must be being used for nefarious purposes. And yet now we take so much for granted, the things that we're able to do on our phones. I mean, Pumi, I use navigation all the time. I used to actually leave home only after I'd looked at a map to see where I had to go, back in the good old days. Sia thinks this is...
I had a map book, dude. I had a map book. I was that person. Grid map.
Yeah.
Where am I going?
Me too.
Page 56.
And now, thank you very much. We'll have even faster connectivity while we're on the go. So thank you, Rian Nell. And a little bit of an update there for anybody who's interested. You can also find out more by going to cliffcentral.com. Now, speaking of cliffcentral.com, we launch a brand new season of Blind History.
Happy!
Dude, don't you dare, Sia. Now we hear that facetiousness in your tone.
What do you mean?
This is by far one of the coolest experiences you can have on a podcast. It makes you smarter. People must listen to Blind History. It makes you smarter. It helps you navigate the world.
That's the Pumimashiko stamp. Yeah, yes.
It is. And this morning, we start off with the first episode of season four. I can't believe we're in season four already. And we've decided on a few really interesting and quite varied targets for the episodes in this season. And we decided to start off with ancient Israel, ancient Judah, ancient Palestine, the place of mystery, the cradle of religion. You know the names of King David and King Solomon, for example. They're referred to in the tapestry of Middle Eastern history as being paragons of kingship. These guys were the model of kingship for the Middle Ages. And we don't know that much about them, actually. So Anthony and I went and did a whole bunch of research, and you know we've co-hosted this series from the get-go together. It's brought to you by Taylor Blinds and Shutters, of which Anthony Medera is the CEO. And it's an award-winning series, this. So let's continue winning awards. And hopefully you get to enjoy it as much in season four as you have for all the others. Tell your friends. We've got an 8-year-old fan called Max, who is the biggest Blind History fan of all. He's listened to every episode at least twice. And he's been on my case for the last 3 months. He's like, where is the next season of Blind History? Unacceptable that he's had to wait.
Ask and you shall receive, Max. Yeah.
So Max, who is 8 years old, who's the biggest Blind History fan, we're happy to introduce to you Season 4, Episode 1. Blind History, here it is, Ancient Israel. Thank you very much, Pumilele. Thank you very much, Sia. And thank you most especially to you, as well as our guests, Rian Nell and also Jean-Jacques Cornish, who is part of a brand new feature brought to you on cliffcentral.com by Joburg Business School. Right now. Blind History, brought to you by Taylor Blinds and Shutters. We will see you tomorrow at 6 o'clock. Take a listen to this. And Solomon measured its length, 20 cubits, and the width, 20 cubits, before the nave. And he said to me, this will be the most holy place. And so it was that King Solomon, the wisest man who ever lived, came to build the most holy building in all of architecture. A building so full of mystery that Isaac Newton studied it obsessively. A building the Freemasons based their entire creed around. The most sacred site for the oldest of monotheistic religions. And according to the ancient Israelites, the very dwelling place of God. Well, this is season 4, episode 1 of Blind History, which is brought to you by Taylor Blinds and Shutters. My co-host, as ever, the history nerd like me, Anthony Medera. It's so good to start a brand new season, Anton. We've had lots of people complaining that they had to wait between seasons, including our biggest 8-year-old fan, who's someone called Max, who sent me an email just the other day and a video to say these are his suggestions of what he wants to hear in the next season. So we've got all our work ahead of us.
Gareth, I'm also very, very excited. I was itching to start season 4. And you know, when you talk about one of our biggest supporters, that's very, very exciting. It's, you know, 8 years old and listening to it and also giving us direction. I think that's what drives us.
That's amazing. So it's really the reason we've decided to do a fourth season is because there's so much history we haven't done yet. And there's lots of exciting stuff. We've actually decided on a few of the people that we want to cover in this season. But of course, if you have suggestions, you can always get hold of us and let us know who you'd like to hear about. So today we're talking about ancient Israel, which is a massive category of personalities and of periods in that part of the world, the Levant. Obviously, there are three sources for ancient Israel and its history. And the one is obviously the Bible, the Hebrew Bible. The other is archaeology, which is increasingly becoming important because we can't verify much of what is in the Bible. And then there are non-biblical sources too. You know, the Romans kept pretty good records. The Egyptians kept decent records. But in those periods where those kingdoms and empires were in decline, they neglected to keep good records. And those are precisely the times where characters like King David and King Solomon came to be. The first mention I could find of the word Israel comes from a tablet that was crafted by the courtiers of Pharaoh Merneptah in Egypt. And he mentions laying waste to Israel. And that's really the first mention of it. Of course, it wasn't a kingdom at that stage, but it was a collection of tribes. And I don't know about you, Ant, but you told me about a book, which I'm looking at right now, by Simon Sebag Montefiore. He's a great historian, called Jerusalem. This thing absorbed me completely.
Yeah, me too. It's incredible. And it starts right at the very, very beginning. I mean, it's 3,000 years ago and even some more. And it's always very difficult to know what's myth and what is truth because it's just such a long time ago.
Well, according to the earliest sources, and some of these are biblical, the original city of Zion, long before it became the city of David and then Jerusalem, was basically the hill of Mount Moriah, where Abraham was ordered by God to sacrifice his eldest son. And that was supposedly the first time that that mountain in the middle of an otherwise unremarkable part of the world became the holiest site on earth. From there on, obviously, a lot of it, as you say, is shadowy and mythological. But there is reasonable evidence to show that that area was already inhabited 5,000 years before Christ.
Yeah, 100%. There was a mention, Gareth, you could correct me if I'm wrong, about even Adam and Eve being around that area. When they worshipped later on, they would say this is the place of Abraham and Adam and Eve.
Wow. Look, what we do know for sure is that the first time Jerusalem became important was really during the reign of King David. And just before that, it had been a place that was more or less inhabited by people called Canaanites, the land of Canaan, which was promised to the Jews upon their exodus from Egypt under Moses. Moses never actually went into the promised land. He had to look at it from Mount Nebo. And that, again, you've got to give us a little bit of a break here when it comes to what's mythology and what's history, because there are things being discovered all the time which back up some of the stories in the Bible. And there are also things which obviously do no service to those things. But David was supposedly a shepherd and later a warrior of some renown. He certainly had musical talents, so he was a remarkable kid. His father was a man called Jesse. And the prophet Samuel was directed by the people of the tribes of what was then Israel to look for a leader. They needed a king. He chose a guy called Saul, who was a warrior. And Saul was good at conquering, but not much else. And he also had probably some kind of mental illness, or certainly a mean streak. And Samuel kept looking, and he found the one son of Jesse, this kid called David, and saw that he had remarkable talents. And he looked, according to Samuel, to be godly. And what we know about him is that he defeated this giant called Goliath at a massive battle. Goliath was a Philistine, and that word has come to mean people who are uncultured and people who have no sophistication in modern parlance. But apparently this was a battle that was won, because we know that there is evidence that Israel at that stage had started to conquer some small areas in that part of what is Palestine today.
Yeah, just a little bit of an interesting thing about the name of Philistine. It does talk about, you know, just uncultured, etc. But it just so happened that the Philistines, mm-hmm, we're a lot more cultured than the sheep, yeah, boys from the top of the hill. So it was quite ironic.
Yeah, and they were better warriors.
Yeah, correct. So it's quite ironic that it came out like that.
After all of this, which is conjectural, and really the only history of David that we have is from the Bible, up until they discovered one inscription in 1993 on a tablet called the Tel Dan tablet, which mentions the house of David, not as a place, but as a dynasty. And so that gives reasonable backing. It certainly helps the case that David was a real man and that he actually existed and that his family continued to reign in ancient Israel for some time. But evidence for all of this other stuff is quite scarce. of course, we know that David was a military man. He conquered various areas around there. Whether his kingdom was huge or small is up for a huge amount of argument too. But after him, and we'll get back to David perhaps a little bit later on, because there were stories about him falling in love with Bathsheba and how he wrote Psalms and many other of the books of the Bible. But after that, Solomon took over, which and Solomon was not his eldest son. Solomon was chosen because he was pure. And the reason for that is that David had wanted to build a temple for God on Mount Zion. And God said, no, I'm afraid not. You've just killed too many people. You've spilt too much blood. You're not a pure person. And it was left to Solomon to do that.
Yeah, and Solomon plays such a big role. I think he's the greatest king, as they call him.
Well, he was supposedly the wisest and he was supposedly the purest. And God asked him, what do you want? And when he said wisdom, God was so impressed that he gave it to him himself. He said, here you are. You're now the wisest man that will ever live. Because most of the people who God had said, what do you want, had said, I want to live forever, or I want military victories, or I want you to kill my enemies. So he was quite impressed by that. And Solomon managed, through God's good graces, to build the first temple in Jerusalem, a site that is considered by Jews to have been the most holy site of all because it contained the Ark of the Covenant. And all subsequent temples built on that site, including the second one, of which only the Wailing Wall remains, didn't have the Ark of the Covenant in it. This Ark of the Covenant deserves an episode on its own, but it was essentially the wooden chest that was built by the Israelites leaving Egypt at the foot of the mountain where God gave the tablets of the commandments to Moses. And the Ark of the Covenant was a very holy relic. You know, it's probably one of the most searched for items in archaeology. People are just obsessed with trying to find this thing because it was meant to be the thing in which God lived on earth. Between the wings of these two cherubs on its lid was something called the mercy seat, from which God himself spoke and lived. And only once a year could the high priest of Israel see God and look upon the Ark of the Covenant. People who tried to carry it were struck dead. It had enormous power. It brought down the walls of Jericho, according to the Bible. But either way, the search for this incredible artifact continues to this day. It's one of the most mysterious things in the world.
And more than likely, Gareth, it's been destroyed, you know, or it's so difficult to say because there was Jerusalem was flattened so many times. And it's such a tumultuous history. It's so very difficult to figure out what actually happened to it.
Well, it was supposed to contain the two tablets and then Aaron's rod and a pot of manna, which was the stuff that God let fall from heaven to feed the people in the desert. But either way, it was considered the most holy place and the most holy thing on earth. And to this day, the Jewish people, the Christian people, the Muslim people revere the site of where the Ark once was as being the most holy place on earth. So it's quite incredible. And obviously Jerusalem, as you say, was flattened. First of all, it was besieged by the Assyrians in 705 BC. And by the way, under Solomon, the kingdom had split into a north and south kingdom. Israel was actually the northern kingdom and Judah, where Jerusalem is, was the southern kingdom. And they fought over taxes and labor and ordinary stuff. But by the time the Assyrians besieged the place in 705 BC, it was really quite a weak state. They say again, because of the presence of the Ark, the Assyrians failed to take Jerusalem. That doesn't seem to have gotten the way of Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon. In 587 BC, he ended the kingdom and he took the people of Judah into slavery and took them off to Babylon, which famously, you know, the story of Daniel in the Bible comes from there and all the rest. That was also the moment at which the Ark stopped being mentioned in any way, shape, or form.
But Gareth, if I just go back to the three kings, Saul, obviously the first king of Israel, because prior to that, it was judges. And obviously this, you know, in the biblical sense, they wanted to appoint a king on earth. So this made God very cross. And we know about Saul, and he was bipolar. You mentioned a little bit earlier. So he had a few challenges.
I'm going to say also, if Saul is bipolar, it's worth saying that God at this point was a very cross God.
Very. I mean, it was scary. He had no patience whatsoever.
None. And was completely unforgiving of almost every small infraction. I mean, you know, David cheated with this woman called Bathsheba, and God killed their eldest child. It's just, he did not mess around.
Yeah. But although having said that, David did, he managed to sort of move the husband of Bathsheba out the way.
Yeah, so, he sent him to war.
Yeah, and in the front, right in the very front of the queue.
Put him in the hottest part of the battle that he be smitten.
Yeah. But if we just look at the three kings and we talk about Solomon and his reign, it was just, you know, if we look at it purely from a historical perspective, and all the people we've looked at during blind history, I mean, this guy was impressive. I mean, he had through ingenious reforms and innovation, such as he improved the defense measures. He had a fleet of ships, expansion of the royal court, financial windfalls from taxation and labor and conscriptions.
He is supposed to have been extremely wealthy, right?
Yes. But what he did was his strategy was through marriages of, he had apparently 700 wives and 300 concubines. And he just married from all different regions around. And that's what started building the trade routes from Egypt, from India, from the West, right across to the East into the Mediterranean and the Red Sea. So he was prolific, absolutely prolific in what he did.
Yeah, there's no doubt that whoever this Solomon was, and whether he was, we still haven't got enough archaeological evidence to definitely say that there was a King Solomon between this and that date. I mean, they assume his reign would have followed David's, so that's somewhere around, 970 BC. But he's supposed to have had this throne, which was a mechanical object which could move and which had gears in it, and it was made of gold, and it had these beasts on the steps, and it sounds like probably one of the most complicated machines ever described in ancient history. And if it is true that this thing existed, it was probably taken off to Babylon when they eventually looted Jerusalem, along with all the other treasures. But that wouldn't be the first or the last time that Jerusalem was flattened. Supposedly, and we've covered him in one of our other episodes, which is what's so nice about history, is that you end up connecting the dots. Once the Jews had been captured in Babylon, within a few years, which, I mean, it could be a span of several decades, but they were eventually conquered by the Persians, who we've spoken about before. And King Cyrus, or Emperor Cyrus the Great, was the one who eventually released the Jews and said, you can go back to Jerusalem and start up your civilization again.
Cyrus the Great was very much a person that allowed whoever you wanted to believe in or what religion you wanted to practice. He didn't have a problem. He didn't enforce it. And that actually, I mean, he was mentioned very, very favorably in biblical sense of what he did and what he stood for.
Well, the Jews went back to Jerusalem. And after that, obviously, Alexander conquered Persia. And we're talking over the span of a couple of hundred years here. But there was a Seleucid empire established in Alexander's wake, because Seleucus Nicator was the first ruler there after Alexander. And until about the 2nd century BC, the Seleucid Empire was established. But then along came a guy called Simon Maccabeus. And this was the first time since Babylon had conquered Jerusalem that the Israelites, the people of that part of the world, the Jews, had their own leadership. Do you want to tell us a little bit about the Maccabeans?
So Alexander, who's one of my favorites, basically conquered the known world, and even the unknown world at that time. But obviously he passed away at the age of 32. And correctly, as you said, his three generals, basically his empire was split between his generals. And the ones that we're talking about were the Seleucid and also Ptolemy. So Ptolemy went on, he took over Egypt, and he also took Alexander's body. His dynasty went right up to Cleopatra's time with Julius Caesar and Mark Antony. But they were fighting between him and the other general in the north. We're fighting for Judea, and Seleucid won and Ptolemy fell away. And what happened was the later generations of his particular lineage, they started to look poorly on the Jewish, and they took away their autonomy. And first of all, the father, he's Antiochus the Third. He wasn't too strict in terms of what they did, but he tried to enforce them to stop circumcision and praying on the Sabbath. But his son was the one that really took all autonomy away from the Jews. It was Antiochus the Fourth. Apparently, they said he was a beautiful man, but he was unhinged. They say he was the Caligula of this particular region. And he just went in and he killed pigs on the altar in Jerusalem, in the Holy of Holies. It was just
basically a complete heretic.
Exactly, 100%. And then a lot of the Jews, obviously fearing for their lives, etc., they're sort of following the Hellenicism. Sorry, I don't know if I pronounced that correct. Yeah, but
the Hellenic belief. So they started taking on, you know, the works of Epicurus, for example. And Epicurean became slang for the kind of breakaway religion that was founded by the Maccabeans.
Correct. And then basically there was the Maccabees, which they were called later, but their father, which is Matthias, he was actually, he saw one of the Jewish people that was now worshipping idols. And there was also a member of the soldiers that also was doing the same. And so he killed them. He actually cut off the head of the Jew and he killed the soldier. And so now suddenly the Antiochus IV was very, very upset. He sent a small little army out. He thought this should be quite easy, a couple of shepherds with a few sheep and one or two men. This should be done quite easily. But Matthias had five sons, and they managed to get quite a serious group of people together and a type of guerrilla warfare. And they decimated that small group. So then he himself came in and brought a bigger army, and they also once again decimated that, and they managed then to take back what they'd lost over the years with the Seleucids and then re-cleanse Jerusalem. But at the time, Matthias was quite old and Judea was the strong one. He was the warrior brother, as you call it, because there were five brothers, and he was the one that really started gaining territory almost to the stage similar to the time of Solomon.
The interesting thing for me about that period is that essentially there could have been a turn to the left or a turn to the right for the Jewish religion, and it might have changed the whole course of human history. Because if the Jews had turned towards Hellenism, it would have been a very different world that we might have inhabited today. And of course, it would have been a very different world for the Jews. And what happened with the Maccabees essentially is that they reasserted the Jewish religion, and partly by forced conversion. So it didn't leave much option for the people who were still in that area and wanted to live. But it's an interesting part of the story. Of course, after that, the Hasmonean dynasty, the Maccabees, was more or less wiped out by Pompey in 63 BC when he, another person from our stories about Julius Caesar now, took over. And Herod the Great was the last king. He was a puppet king, essentially, between 73 BC and 4 BC. He built the second temple. And he also built the amazing Palace of Masada, which became a stronghold for the Zealots in 73 AD. And that was really the last gasp of the Jewish people. Because after that, after the massacre at Masada, the Jewish people were desolated. And they went on their diaspora. And really, the Jews were strangers in foreign lands for the rest of their history until Israel was established in 1948. It's a long period to be wandering in the desert.
It was a very long period. And that's why, you know, why I was so fascinated by the Maccabees. It's just, and it's not, wasn't the first time during that period that, you know, the small group of warriors managed to take down the might of, it was very similar to the Greeks taking out the Persian kings. So he was called, Judea was called the hammer. Because, you know, the way he was a proper warrior, he was killed in battle. But prior to that, and I mentioned earlier, the re-cleansing of the temple, and there was a story about the oil lamp that was basically ran out, but it carried on burning and kept the light going for 8 days. And this, obviously, this miracle inspired the Hanukkah Festival of Lights, which Jewish people still celebrate religiously today. And that's basically the freedom from tyranny. And he was killed, and then his brother took over, Jonathan the Cunning. What he did is all the conquests that his brother did, he started organizing. He was very diplomatic and he started getting political balance in place. He offered Judea support. There was a lot that he'd organized in terms of how he was governing the region. Unfortunately, he was tricked and he was also killed. And then Simon, who actually became Simon the Great, which you referred to earlier, he was the youngest of the Maccabees and now the only surviving son. And he was the one that finally established what the dad and the brothers were all fighting for, was the Hasmonean dynasty, which you mentioned earlier.
I know we've skipped through a lot of the chapters of ancient Israel in quite a cursory way, but I think there's so much here. And we wanted to squeeze it into an episode because, you know, Saul, David, and Solomon, people know these names and they are venerated as, you know, holy saints in almost all the religions. But the fact that the story of the Jewish people in Israel is just so deep and so soulful and so connected to not only the geography of that area and the religion of that area and the fact that many battles were waged and great stories have come from it. But essentially, this is stuff that everybody learns in Bible study. It's stuff that is a central tenet of all three of the major monotheisms. And there isn't a person in the Western world who doesn't know about King David or King Solomon's wisdom or any of that stuff. It's really a beautiful story, if nothing else. And we are finding more and more evidence by the day that a lot of these stories turn out to actually have been historical fact.
That's what's very exciting for me. But there was a fourth as well of the monotheism. It was the Rastafarian, the Queen of Sheba, which they believe is from modern Yemen, came to visit Solomon's kingdom, and she brought gold with, et cetera, et cetera. And I think there is a story, it could be a myth, whatever it is, that they had an intimate relationship and they had a child. And that child, later on, Haile Selassie, was a descendant from that relationship that the Queen of Sheba and King Solomon had.
And by the way, Ant, one of the things that makes Ethiopia interesting, and we'll cover that in a future episode, is that at Aksum in Ethiopia is a church which the Christian Coptic Church believes to contain at very least the actual Ark and at most a replica of the Ark of the Covenant. But it's so amazing that this is the story of the Jewish people and their trials and tribulations over thousands of years that we've tried to digest into just one short episode. And it's interesting that Cassius Dio says at the end at Masada, 580,000 Jewish men were slaughtered by the Romans. That really was a death knell for the Jewish people.
Their story is just an incredible story. I mean, you shed tears. You have such incredible highs, David and Solomon, the golden age.
Of course, we've left Jesus out of this because it was in ancient Israel that Jesus was born. And supposedly that this was a man of history, and there are some records that are cropping up here and there to substantiate things that are in the Bible, but that this man was born in Jerusalem, in the kingdom of David, that he was a descendant of King David, and that he was the founder of the world's biggest religion.
You're right. He was born in Bethlehem, where David was also born.
Yeah, died in Jerusalem.
Correct, yeah, died in Jerusalem. So, and funny enough, then I think believe David also died in Jerusalem, but I'm not 100% sure of that. But yes, so he was descendant of David. So there has a link right through.
Very, very interesting period of history. I'm delighted we've covered it, and I hope you're ready for more in season 4. Blind History is brought to you by Taylor Blinds and Shutters. All the episodes are available on the cliffcentral.com website and app, as well as Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Philistines came from an area or a town called Gath, and that's where the word git comes from. So they got a bit of a rough break.
Cliffcentral.com.